three major divisions of the sedimentary layers, the geologic column. And the major part of it, down here in the Paleozoic, forms at the rate, we're told, of 1 foot per 2,700 years. Almost 3,000 years to form a foot of limestone or sandstone. Now, somebody sat around and watched that for 2,700 years. You think? No. Well, how did they reach that conclusion? Well, they know how long this has been forming, and they know how much is there, and so they divide the time into the rock, and they come up with 2,700 years. And then they turn around and say, well, see, it takes 2,700 years, and therefore we can see how many feet we got, and we know how long. You see the circular logic that's involved there. You begin with a conclusion and divide the rock layers into the assumed time, and you get the answer, and then you use that answer to turn around and do your calculations. Well, that's not proof of anything. Some of them reach different conclusions. Here, Officer and Drake say 1 centimeter per 1,000 years is typical. Now, that's not very much, and that's a long period of time. And they're just all kinds of... But that's what happens... That's how the rock layers are built up, we're told. But just think about it. I think the cartoon from Family Circus hints at the problem. Here's a little boy that says, how big does a stone have to grow before it becomes a rock? Do stones grow? Well, yeah, at the rate of 2,700 years a foot. Stones grow. Well, that's not really what we see happening to stones, is it? Stones deteriorate. They don't grow. If rocks grew, you could build yourself a rock house, and over the years you'd get extra bedrooms and dens. And that's not the way it works, is it? And we see just nonsensical statements. In our national parks, for example, there's a beautiful fossil of a wolf spider. Just incredibly preserved. And this is from the Florissant fossil beds up in Colorado. Here's a sign that we see in this national park that we're helping to pay for that says, remember, 2 inches equals 1 million years. It takes 1 million years. And at that rate, you get this beautiful preserved spider. People don't stop and think, but just try. You know, it won't hurt. Let's think about that. Here's a human hair, the width of the human hair. At the rate 2 inches per million years, it'd take 2,500 years to cover the hair. Now, at that rate, what's going to happen to the spider while it's being covered? Is that hard to figure out? Are you going to get this beautifully preserved fossil at that rate? That's what it says. But just think about it. That's not possible. The spider is going to be gone in a week while he's being covered. One of his hairs takes 25. This is nonsense. It's not even very good nonsense. Dunbar and Rogers wrote the book that I was taught from, actually at two different state universities, Principles of Stratigraphy. And they talk about this. To some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery, the idea of billions of years supposed to be proved by the radiometric dating, this discovery presented a dilemma. Now, many people would think if you study the rocks, the stratigraphers, the ones who study the strata, they know that it takes a long time. Well, he says, no, they know this is a problem. This is a dilemma. For if the known stratified rocks have been accumulating throughout this vast span of time, the average rate of deposition must have been extremely slow, such as Schuster calculated, yet there's very good evidence that individual beds accumulated rapidly. Now, people that are stratigraphers that study the strata know this is a problem because you look at the rocks and they're just a bunch. Now, what kind of evidence is he talking about? Very good evidence. Well, you look at fossils like this. This looks like a shrimp, doesn't it? This is not a shrimp. This is a rock. But it became a rock how quickly? How long did it take this to form? What's going to happen to the shrimp if it takes a week? You ladies know you can put the shrimp in the refrigerator and it'll just stay there for years and years. What happens when it dies and lays out there on the beach? You waiting for a rot to grow around it? Does that make any sense at all? How long did it take this rock to form? If that rock didn't form within hours, you're not going to have a shrimp that looks like this. And so when you look at the individual beds, you know this is a problem to say it happened slowly. This is a dilemma. We're looking at these big, fat, juicy-looking fish. This is from about 2 miles from where I live in Texas. How long is that fish going to look like that? It'll lay out there on the beach and look like that, fat and juicy, and for a day. It begins to shrivel up, and it's not going to look like that a week. Here's a fish in the process of eating his supper, caught in the sandstone. Now, I eat with my brethren from time to time and enjoy that. And some of them are kind of slow and they take a long time, and that may be a little, but now, taking 100 million years or 100,000 years, covering this fish at the rate of 2 inches equals a million years, are you going to get a picture like that? He got caught in the concrete, didn't he? And that's the only way in the world you can preserve that. You're looking here at a fossil fern, and the fern hasn't even wilted. But it's a rock. Now, how long did it take that rock to form? Just think about that. It won't hurt. Think about it. How long did it take the rock to form? It had to form within hours. How long does it take a fern to wilt? We're looking at the fossil fern here at the top compared to the fern held in a spring-like position down at the bottom. It hadn't even had time to spring back before it wilted. It has to be a rock before those things happen. Now, individual layers show fossils like this, and you try to form that at the rate of 2 inches equals a million years, and this is a dilemma. I mean, this you just can't explain it that way. It doesn't work. We're looking here at a tree that's in the base at a coal seam. At the top, there's another coal seam. And here is the tree extending through both of them with dozens of layers in between. Now, the coal seam is supposed to have taken hundreds of thousands of years. And then the other layers, at the rate of 2 inches, equals a million years. Does that make sense? What's going to happen to the top of the tree? I mean, just think. You know, I know what they tell you, but think about it. It's nonsense. We're looking at dozens of layers here. And is this millions of years or thousands of years or even hundreds of years? Or is this one event? This is one catastrophic event that buried this and preserved it and formed the rock quickly. We find some places, like this picture from France, where at least 100 of these trees are piled, covered and turned into rock. Notice they're truncated top and bottom. The roots and the top system is... They've probably been transported, broken off at top and bottom. What would do that? And bury trees like this in place? Well, it'd have to be something like a flood, wouldn't it? But to accomplish that sort of thing. And even geologists look at that and say, well, yeah, we've got to have something. It must have been a local flood. And after about 4 years of arguing with one of the professors that I had, finally he said, the best explanation for the fossil record is 10,000 local floods. Well, we're making progress. But we can show that that's not the case as well. Back to Dunbar and Rogers again in Principles of Stratigraphy. 1,000 years, more or less, and he's talking about in terms of Schuster's calculation, which is in all of the books, 1,000 years, more or less, would have been required to bury a shell 5 inches in diameter. Now, what's going to happen in 1,000 years? He says, with very local exceptions, fossil shells show no evidence of such long exposure. That's the dilemma. Some of these fossil shells that are large, this one is about 12 inches across. Some of them are up to 6 feet across, these ammonites. Beautifully preserved, but 1,000 years to cover 5 inches, that's at the slow rate. It just doesn't make sense, as he acknowledges. And it gets worse. You look at the ocean today, and many of you would recognize the jellyfish. This is an animal that's just as close to being nothing as you can get and still be an animal. It's just, as one little girl told me the other day, that's just a bunch of snot. That's pretty close. That's about what it is. It lays out on the beach when it dies, and it's going to stay there for thousands of years. Does that make sense? We have fossils of them. These are fossils of jellyfish. Now, you think about it. How long did it take this rock to form? Quick enough to preserve the jellyfish. Now, that's got to be pretty fast concrete, even, to preserve the jellyfish. We look at some of the fossils. This is from the Solnhofen limestone in Bavaria. This is an ichthyosaur. Looks like a fish. It isn't. It's a reptile. That we'll get more to that, I believe, Friday evening. But this is about 28 feet long, and it's perfectly preserved in the limestone that formed at the rate of 2,700 years a foot. You think? Is that going to fly? Well, it gets worse. You look carefully at the head area. Here's the adipose, the fatty tissue that is beautifully preserved there in the forehead. In the abdomen, we see this is a mommy ichthyosaurus. She has the baby ichthyosaur, the embryo, in the womb. They did give live birth, and obviously a number of these got caught in a trauma and triggered premature birth, because we see a number of them in the process of giving birth to the baby ichthyosaur frozen in the limestone at the rate of 2,700 years a foot. Looking close, you see the baby coming out of the birth canal. Now, some of the ladies think, you know, I can sympathize. It seems like it takes a long time to get that process over with. But, no, it doesn't take thousands of years, does it? The beautifully preserved fossils of things like this just scream that a million years equals 2 inches is nonsense. Just absolute not even real good nonsense. This is North Carolina State University. This is Willow, a dinosaur that has become well known there in that area because it's so beautifully preserved. Notice the statement that's made. What are the odds of finding a fossilized dinosaur heart? The seemingly impossible occurred within the 36 million year old skeleton. Well, you see these programs where they're transplanting hearts, and here they've got a heart, and they put it in this special container, and they get in the helicopter, and they dash across the roof, and they bring the heart, because it's deteriorating, right? Well, here's the chest area of the dinosaur. Here's the heart right here in the center that is now a rock. When we do the CAT scan, or the x-ray here, this is the collarbone, the clavicle. Here is the neck bone. But right in the center, we have the left ventricle and the right ventricle. Left ventricle, right ventricle of the dinosaur heart. We even have the intraventricular septum in the center that is beautifully preserved. And it gets worse. We look at the thin sections of some of the bone structure. This is published in 1993 in Science. And these are blood cells in a T-Rex bone. Now, how long are blood cells going to last? Not very long. You keep it refrigerated or it's going to be gone just very, very quickly. Reported in Science, we read, round, tiny, nucleated, they were threaded through the bone like red blood cells and blood vessels, but blood cells and dinosaur bone should have disappeared eons ago. I got goosebumps. It was exactly like looking at a slice of modern bone. The bones are, after all, 65 million years old. How could blood cells survive that long?
Well, that's, I think the answer is obvious. If you just open the mind a little bit. This young lady who was doing this as a grad student has now become a doctor. And she is at North Carolina State University and has continued this kind of research. Now, she was chided for this by several, even though Science published it, and she did excellent work and documented it, so they did publish it, even though a lot of folks didn't like it. But now then, she's continued and got even more, and there's just no way to argue with what she has. She's found soft tissue in dinosaur bones. This is a picture of it. It's impossible, according to many, and of course it is impossible if you're talking about millions of years. In a personal communication with her, she says, regarding this, our current theories do not account for soft tissue and cellular preservation. Now, there's no way for soft tissue to be maintained for a million years. I mean, it's just, and this is 65 million. Never in my wildest dreams would I have predicted what we found. Now, making predictions is one of the things you do to test models, and what she found contradicted her predictions. She said, and this was published in Discover magazine just last year, an interview that she had with some skeptics. She says, I had one reviewer tell me he didn't care what the data said. He knew that what I was finding wasn't possible. I wrote back and said, well, what data would convince you? And he said, none. Doesn't matter what you find, I'm not going to believe it. Because he knows the dinosaurs are 65 million years old and there's no way you can find soft tissue. She's just found all kinds of it. Blood vessels, blood cells, this elastic, stretchy, squishy tissues in the dinosaur bone. Well, I think that has a very clear implication. I think that says the dinosaur fossils are not old. Some are not willing to say that, but they sure can't explain the soft tissue preservation. Fossils just belie the idea that these layers are billions of years old. And many now are accepting that, and many of them, the more up-to-date geology textbooks will acknowledge, well, yes, we know the individual layers had to form rapidly. There's no way that you can do it slowly and have the preservation that we have of some of these fossils. And so we're looking here at what is often touted as a reason for the great age of the earth. But if the fossils in the layers formed rapidly, then what does that say about the layers? Wouldn't that say the layers had to form rapidly? And you've got fossils in all of these layers. So all of these layers had to form rapidly, and that's not the picture you hear in the textbook. Well, then where is the time? Well, that gets to be a difficult question, and you see the squirming taking place, but they've come up with an answer. The answer today is the time is in between the layers. And I had this in response. A fellow just stood up and interrupted my lecture at Texas A&M University and said, we know the layers form rapidly. We understand that. The time is in between the layers. I said, you mean where there is no evidence? And he just kind of sunk down. And actually, it's worse than that because there is evidence between the layers, as we'll see. Let's let them describe this process themselves and their thinking. Derek Eger, when this was written, was president of the British Geological Association. And notice the title of his book, The New Catastrophism. He's recognizing that it takes rapid formation of these sediments in order to preserve the fossils as we see them. We cannot escape the conclusion that sedimentation was at times very rapid. Indeed, at other times there were long breaks. Now, he doesn't have evidence for the long breaks, but and he knows they had to form, the layers formed rapidly, but has to be breaks because we know there is lots of time involved and you have to for evolution. It looks uniform and continuous, but we believe there were long breaks even though it looks different. And yes, you look at it and it looks uniform and continuous. It looks like one came right after the other, after the other. And one of the very obvious reasons, a geologist knows it looks that way, is from a phenomenon we call bioturbidation. Here's a layer that you see, for example, at the bottom of the ocean or anywhere else, and it's maybe a knife edge, just as smooth, and maybe a hurricane comes by and leaves this layer, and it's flat and level, but within weeks you see the little roots going down and you see the worms burrowing through, and they just plow this thing up, and that fine edge disappears and destroys the smooth surfaces through bioturbidation. You don't see that here. You see one layer right after the other looking continuous. But back to Eger's statement. He says that the geological record is constantly lying to us. You have to understand you can't believe everything you see, is basically what he's saying. It pretends to tell us the whole truth when it's only telling us a very small part of it. Nowhere in the world is the record or even part of it complete. In other words, there's a lot more that went on than you see. I mean, it looks quick, but there had to be more than that. It may seem paradoxical, but to me, the gaps probably cover most of Earth history. Now, a scientist is supposed to go by what he can see, the evidence. But he's going by what he can't see, that he believes is there, the gaps where there's nothing. That's where it all happened, and that's where he has to put the time. It was during the breaks that most of the events probably occurred. Well, how do you know? Well, there's no evidence there. Actually, there is, but it's negative. It's the gaps that really matter. Now, can you imagine trying to make an argument like in Scripture, and you just base the whole thing and everything you believe on what's not there? It's certainly not good science. Let's look at some of the gaps. This is one very dramatic example. We're looking at the Coconino Sandstone down at the base of the Grand Canyon. It overlies the Hermit Shale. But the Hermit Shale is supposed to be much, much older. The Coconino Shale, much, much younger, based on the fossils that are in it. And so the conclusion is there's 110 million years missing here. Well, you explain that by erosion. If you've got deposition here, you've got to have erosion somewhere else. So there was erosion here, but does that line in between the two look like an erosion line? It's just a knife edge. I know a little bit about erosion. Most people do. It doesn't leave lines look like that, does it? I don't believe that's 30 years of erosion, let alone 110 million years of erosion. And that's what you see between all of these layers, these straight knife edge lines that you can trace for 300 miles from one end to the canyon to the other. Without the bioturbidation in between, it's uniform and continuous. Each one happened rapidly and the other followed rapidly. But they try to put the time in between. Well, let's look in between. Look at the interface of these layers, and we see little bird tracks. Now, in order for the bird tracks to be preserved, this host rock that they're in had to form rapidly. That's just like the concrete out front. If it takes 10 years for that concrete to form, you're not going to preserve bird tracks, are you? But if it hardens quickly and a bird walks across it, you might get some. This host rock had to form rapidly. Plus, what's going to happen if it does form rapidly and then it's just exposed to the elements for another 10 years? It's going to erode. It's going to disappear. And so the next rock had to come quickly to protect it, to keep it from eroding. So it had the base rock had to form quickly. The next rock on top of it had to form rapidly. The same implication is true for ripple marks. This is the most common feature that you find in sedimentary rock. Notice the statement by Schrock in his rock book that we all had to virtually memorize. He says, because they are one of the commonest, most widespread original sedimentary features, ripple marks are preserved in conglomerates, sandstones, siltstones, plastic limestones, dolestones. Many examples have been described from rocks of all ages, I would say from all environments. But all kinds of rock, all, quote, ages, just everywhere. In fact, it's been said that if you follow any bedding plane far enough, you will see a ripple mark. Now, what do the ripple marks say? These are some from down at Glen Rose here with the dinosaur tracks for the same application. Again, this rock that they're in had to form rapidly in order to preserve it. Those ripple marks last for just minutes, maybe hours, and then the water running over it forms new ones. And then they erode if they're left exposed, and so the next rock has to form rapidly. The host layer has to be rapid. The next layer has to be rapid to prevent erosion. And when we look at layers like this and we see all of these layers have ripple marks, that says all of them had to be rapid, as would be indicated by the fossils within them, and the next one has to come rapidly on top of it, and you get the picture. Each one is rapid, and each one follows the other rapidly in succession. You don't have time in between. There's more evidence that there's not time in between when we look at the interface here in this picture. Very important picture. And you have to think with me here. Here's the Red Wall limestone. This is Mississippi, and this is almost halfway up the column. It's resting directly on the Muav Cambrian. That's the bottom layer. Well, it skips almost 200 million years to go from the Muav to the Red Wall, from the Cambrian to the Mississippi. Okay, but there's erosion. But this is a straight level line. Doesn't look like erosion. Well, it's worse than that, though. Because when we look at the interface, notice the line here points from the Muav to the next layer, which is the Red Wall, and then back to the Muav, and then back to the Red Wall, and then back to the Muav, and back to the Red Wall, and back to the Muav, and back to the Red Wall, and back to the Muav. You see, you skip 200 million years, and you go up to the Red Wall through erosion, but then you go backwards and get some more of the Muav, and then you skip forward 200 million years, and how do you skip 200 million years eight times? When they're interbedded, they have to be contemporaneous. Absolutely no. In fact, that's one of the axioms that we have to memorize. Interbedded layers are contemporaneous. But here are things that are supposed to be 200 million years apart according to the geologic column. They put the time in between, and it will not work. It just absolutely is refuted. If you had nothing else but this picture, you could see that's impossible. They're not 200 million years apart. They had to be laid down at the same time. It looks uniform and continuous, as Eger suggested. But he's going to put breaks in there anyway. It looks uniform and continuous, and it is. Now, how do you get all of these layers forming rapidly? Well, I think we have an excellent demonstration of that with what happened at Mount St. Helens. This is the way it appeared before 1980. In 1980, it blew its top and blew out a tremendous pyroclastic cloud out across the countryside at about 150 to 200 miles an hour, moving tremendous amounts of debris. Spirit Lake is seen here that held for a little while, but the debris was spread over the countryside, and then when the dam broke, it eroded down through that newly laid sediment and left a canyon like this. And that little bitty trickle that you see at the bottom is what cut that canyon. You think? Or was there much, much more water that's virtually gone now, and this little trickle is what's left? There's a more reason. In fact, we know that's what happened. We saw it happen. But it left this canyon with the little stream trickling down the bottom. Does that remind you of anything? This canyon is up to 600 feet thick, and the layers on the side are now hard rock, but these layers on the side were laid down at 150 miles an hour one afternoon in 1980. Not over millions of years. Now, when we were in school, we had to look at these rocks. In fact, get our microscopes out, send a little magnifying glass, and count the layers. And each one was at least a year. And we'd come up with thousands of years to get the right answer on the test. But this was all done one afternoon. It wasn't many years. 600 feet of it can be seen of these finely laminated walls that looked for all the world like the Grand Canyon. But this is actually, some of it came a little bit later, no more than 3 months for the whole process. But does that look like the Grand Canyon? I think it looks, in fact, that is the Grand Canyon. I'm sorry, this is Mount St. Helens. I think we have similar explanations. In fact, we have good demonstration of that. But it reminds me of the cartoon this friend of mine drew. Here's this million-year-old canyon formed by Mount St. Helens in 1980. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that we see in the textbooks. We have a demonstration of catastrophism and what it produces. It produces layers, and it produces them quickly, and produces things that look like the Grand Canyon. And we can see it. That's what science is supposed to be about. Oh, but I believe the time is in between the layers. No, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. But sometimes we're referred to the cave formations, like these speleotherms, that are supposed to take thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. I had a textbook that said it takes 100,000 years to form 1 cubic inch of the speleotherm material that we see illustrated. At that rate, it would take a long time to do this. I really got my eyes opened here at this place. This is George Rogers Clark Memorial while I was in school at Indiana University. It's on the banks of the Wabash River, a clay bank, and this limestone is taken from a quarry that was about 6 miles from where I was going to school there at Bedford, Indiana. There was a Bedford quarry that had limestone exactly like this. In fact, that's where it was taken from. It's the same limestone that built the Empire State Building. Good building stone. But water percolates down through that just like it does in the caves. In fact, this cave that we were just looking at, the one before, I can get back to it. This is within a mile of that Bedford quarry where the limestone came from. That's northern Alabama. But here in the basement of the George Rogers Clark Memorial, you have speleotherms. Water had percolated down through the cracks in the building just like it did in the cave and formed columns up to 11 feet tall. In fact, there were 5 of these columns in the basement of a building that was less than 40 years old. And that said, wait a minute, 100,000 years to form a cubic inch? I don't think so. I know better. I had a friend of mine from New Zealand that sent me this picture of a zinc mine in a tunnel that is 30 years old. You see the people over here in the lower right-hand corner to give you a scale, the concrete abutment there through the center, long speleotherms. Formed less than 30 years. Here, a picture of a soda straw, one of the speleotherms, described here in Arizona highways. While some believe beautiful icicle-looking stalactites take years to form, Jerry Trout, cave specialist with the Forest Service, says he watched through photo monitoring. He's watched a satellite grow several inches in a matter of days. I've interviewed him. He did the time-lapse photography. He says in a month, the thing grew right past the front of his camera and off the frame. It doesn't take a long time. They tell you they know better. This is a picture from Carlsbad Cavern that shows an actual trapped bat in a stalactite. Now, he probably died and landed on top of it, but the stalactite grew around him before he had time to decay. What does this tell you about how long it takes? I mean, we know it doesn't take a long time. But it takes a long time to petrify things, right? This is the boot that I found out in West Texas. It's not petrified, but on the inside we have a cowboy leg that is, with the bones and part of the flesh that is beautifully preserved. When you look at the close-up, you can see the broken bones. We took this to the hospital, had it CAT scanned, and they had to have a name for it. They called it the unfortunate cowboy, but pointed out you could actually see the festered part of the wound that was turned into rock. And so we now call him the limestone cowboy. The boot was made by the Geletti Boot Company in the early 1950s, custom-made boot. Other fossils, this is one of my favorites. Looks like a hat, used to be. It's now a rock. It was in one of the zinc mines there in New Zealand. They say it takes millions of years. They're just talking through their head, aren't they? We say, why do you think the earth's old? Well, it takes a long time to form fossils. It takes a long time to form layers. Not so. We can prove it's not so. In fact, all of it is rapid and continuous. When you look at these polystrate fossils, the fossils that go through many layers, many strata, the detail fossils, like the shrimp or the jellyfish or the ferns and the tall trees, the continuous sequential layers that are clearly indicated by the continuous ripple marks, the ephemeral tracks, Mount St. Helens demonstrating that. When we look at coal that we know had to form rapidly from that tree, we didn't talk about oil, but we can do that in the laboratory in 6 hours. Pressure, heat, garbage produces oil. Cave formations, we see those growing right out of the camera frame. Petrification, what is there in the geologic phenomenon that takes a long time? I like to talk about the geologic phenomenon. This is like tossing Brer Rabbit in the briar patch. You know? Yeah, let's talk about the geologic phenomenon. Where is the time? It's all rapid. And we can prove that it's all rapid. Now, why do you think the earth is old? It's not because of radiometric dating. It's not because of the geologic phenomenon. Why? And now then the reasons don't look so good. Now, we haven't really asked the question, why do you think it's young? But there are real good reasons to think that, as indicated even by Stanfield, who is the anti-creationist. He lists a number of reasons which he still thinks is not as strong as radiometric dating, though he says there's no good radiological clocks. He acknowledges water from volcanoes is a pretty good argument, as well as lava from the volcanoes. We have 600 active volcanoes in the world approximately today. There are about 10,000 inactive. I think that indicates some really bad things went on during the flood with volcanism. But let's just think about the 600 that are active today. Much of what comes out of the volcanoes is steam, is water. The H and the O get together and form the juvenile water coming out of volcanoes, and of course lava comes out. Paracatin is one of the more studied volcanoes in the world, from down in Mexico, and it's typical, it's average, and the one that they normally use as a standard to do calculations with. And if we take the amount of water that's coming out of Paracatin, which is considered average, we find that 70 volcanoes like this would fill the oceans in a billion years. It's supposed to have been there 4.5 billion, but in a billion years, 70 of them would fill the ocean. Nobody thinks all the water came from volcanoes. Actually, when you do 600 of them, you can fill the oceans 8 times. Now, what are you going to do with 7 oceans of water? You got some real... As Stanfield said, this is an indication of a young Earth, not an old Earth. 4, like Paracatin, measuring the lava that comes out, would account for the entire crust of the Earth. And a very small part of the crust is from volcanic lava. And so this just doesn't fit the idea of the old Earth. We look at pressure in oil reservoirs. We bore down into some of these pressure pockets where you have natural gas, and sometimes it'll just blow the rig way up into the sky with tremendous pressures. How long will the rocks preserve that? Well, when you're looking for oil, you know, have to measure the porosity of the rock to know if it'll hold the rock, and it tells you how much pressure can be held. Fairly simple to measure how long you can maintain those pressures. You get a maximum of about 12,000 years for the kind of pressures you've got there. And it's supposed to have been 4.5 billion years. And it's still there. It certainly has not dissipated. Uranium accumulation is very easy to measure in the oceans. It's easy to detect. And you take the rate of accumulation and how much is there, and it certainly doesn't fit the long age. It indicates maybe 12 to 13,000 at the present rate, though I think the rate sped up in the past with the flood. It certainly doesn't indicate billions of years. Radiocarbon in the atmosphere is another argument that indicates that the Earth is young. You take a direct indication from what's there, you're looking at about 8,000 years as the prediction rather than the thousands. And again, that's assuming a constant rate. Helium in the atmosphere indicates the same thing. Meteoric dust. Now, these are the evidences that Sandfield gives. Meteoric dust in the strata is a very dramatic illustration, as well as the meteorites. He says you don't find any. You find some craters in a few places, but where are the meteorites? If this is recording what happened over a long period of time, there ought to be recorded these meteorites that land on, but it's not there. But if it all happened in a year, and we're looking at a flood deposit, then it would be very rare. And actually, we have found some, even though Stanfield says he knows none. It's extremely rare, which shouldn't be the case if this is the record of millions of years. Population dynamics are an excellent argument. We hear about the population explosion, the boom. You take two people, 2,500 years to the time of the flood, which we do calculations on sometimes. How many people were on the earth at the time of the flood? Two people at the present population growth rate till the time of the flood equals about 6 billion people. Well, where are all the people if they've been around 100,000, 200,000, 2 million? We ought to be walking on graveyards, aren't we? It doesn't fit the picture of the great age of the earth. He says, yes, there are indications of the young earth, though he ignores it. There are excellent evidences for the young earth, which just get ignored. Now, as a scientist, we're supposed to look at all of the data. When we look at the evidence for the young earth, there is a lot of it. There are more reasons, and the reasons are better. Now, you may say, okay, there's some reasons for the old earth, but they're not very good reasons, as we've demonstrated. We can say, for the young earth, we have more reasons, and they're better. For the old earth, they're fewer, and they're not so good. Now, what ought you to conclude? Excuse me. I think that speaks for itself. If you're going to be a scientist, if you're going to be honest, you just go with the evidence. The most scientific conclusion is the earth's young. That's not because of Sunday school literature, it's because of the facts. The actual evidence from science. Now, if this hasn't been going on for millions of years, but for just a few thousands of years, then it didn't develop naturally by itself, did it? It had to have been supernaturally created. One of the reasons people like the long ages, billions of years, is that it kind of stiff arms and puts off the sharp edge of accountability that an imminent judgment would imply. If the earth's been here billions of years, you don't worry too much about it in the next Thursday, do you? It's been here for billions of years. But if it was created supernaturally just a few thousand years ago, and the book which describes that accurately says it's coming to an end, now you've got a different picture, don't you? A whole different view of the world that says, you better wake up and get ready. There is a great day coming. God destroyed the earth that then was by water, and He's going to destroy this one by fire. The book that described the beginning describes the end, and it's dependable. It's accurate. The billions of years may be comforting, but it's fiction, and it's not based on fact. If you're here this evening and haven't confessed your faith in Christ, we'd encourage you to do that and be ready when that great day comes, repenting of your sins and being baptized into Christ. Again, if your faith has grown weak, you've wandered away, you need to come back and make that right while we stand and sing.
There's a fountain of praise.